Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a common phenomenon right now. You're a big fan of a movie or a song or an actor, and you love their work. But then you find out that your favorite creative genius does something repulsive. So you ask yourself, is it okay to still be a fan? This is the question that Claire Dieterer explores in her book, Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. Author Nick Hornby says that Monsters is the best work of criticism he has read in a very long time. And I totally agree. Claire writes beautifully about horrible behavior that is difficult to come to terms with.
I was working on a previous book, a memoir that's titled Love and Trouble, and the book deals with growing up as a kid and then a teenager in the culture of kind of sexual predation of the 1970s and 1980s, and sort of what it was like to be a girl during that time when it was almost culturally sanctioned for men to predate you. And in the context of that book, I was thinking a lot about Roman Polanski and his rape of a young girl in that same era. And I sort of took him as this totem figure or straw man for that particular kind of man. And the book is sort of formally inventive or experimental. And so one of the elements of the book was an open letter to Roman Polanski. So in doing that, I really deeply researched what he had done. And yet, as I finished up writing the book, I found that I could still consume his work. I could still watch Rosemary's Baby, or I could still watch Chinatown and think it is a truly great film. And I knew everything he'd done. And in fact, you know, I would never want to co-opt his victim's experience, but I had also been predated. And so, like, there was a complex emotional experience around identifying with her, and yet I could still watch the films. And I thought, you know, I've been a writer for a long time, and I thought this is an interesting problem.
Mm-hmm. There's this very interesting point you make in your book. You say that you finally realized that you weren't trying to find out about the artists, but about the audience. You wanted to write an autobiography of the audience. So how did this idea influence your approach to writing Monsters?
When I first started to think about this problem and talk to people around me, the sort of immediate response was to go over a list of canceled artists or people who'd done rotten things. And I realized that that's just the history of art. We've been dealing with this problem for a long time. And I wasn't interested in sort of a catalog. I was interested in really reverting to what is the audience's experience when they go to consume the art. And in fact, when they're consuming it, what's going on emotionally? What's going on intellectually? What's happening inside me, and what am I seeing happening in the people around me? The book is organized around a bunch of different ideas, and each chapter sort of takes a different artist as a way to look at the idea. But the artists aren't chosen in any kind of comprehensive or exhaustive sense. Instead, they're chosen as kind of lenses or ways to explore the audience experience. So, for instance, one idea I get at is the way that the notion of genius affects our experiences as audience members. Do we use the concept of genius to give artists a pass? What does the genius get to do? What do we expect of the genius? And so in that chapter, I talk about Picasso and Hemingway as these people who really shaped our idea and ideal of the kind of male genius artist.
Mm. Let's talk about Woody Allen. You say that when you were young, you felt like Woody Allen. How so?
For one thing, I will say that we need to remember that in the 1970s, there was a dearth of culture and media compared to what there is now. So if you encountered something with an artist or a piece of art with which you could identify, you sort of pounced on it. Mm-hmm. And Woody Allen had a way in which he was, you know, he's kind of, especially in his early work, he himself is a bit of a kid. He's sort of puncturing societal norms, and he's sort of playing the fool in the face of the adults around him. He's short. He's often in a situation where he has no power, or he perceives himself as having no power. And so I think that there was a way in which I, like many people, identified with him in the context of his work. I mean, it's sort of an absurd thought because I was a young girl, a young Gentile girl, in fact, and here is this great filmmaker, but he presents himself as kind of the underdog in his films. And that's something I think that kids relate to, especially, if I may say, younger siblings.
Mm, yeah, exactly. I think you're exactly right about that. So what was it like for you to rewatch Manhattan?
I was putting off watching Manhattan. It was something I was procrastinating, and I realized I was approaching it with dread. And in fact, when I went back and watched it for the first time since I was a girl when it came out, it was absolutely excruciating. You know, it brings up this really interesting problem. For me, the viewing of Woody Allen is complicated by what I will inelegantly call the Sun Yi thing. My concerns really started in the early 90s, I believe, is when the Walter Isaacson interview came out, and we found out more and more about the Sun Yi relationship. And for me, that was really painful and uncomfortable. You know, my mom has a longtime boyfriend, so it's sort of I'm in a similar position. Like, the idea of having a sexual or romantic relationship with my mom's partner is appalling. You know, and of course, that's always Alan's defense, is like, well, she's not my kid, she's Mia's kid. So there was sort of a way in which the whole thing was distasteful already for me, absent any discussion of the Dylan issue. And when I went back to Manhattan, in fact, it was very upsetting. The opening scene is Woody Allen out to dinner with two of his 40-ish friends, you know, a couple, and it's a double date, and his date is Tracy, who's in high school. It's all being treated as though it's no big deal, which is, you know, very much speaking toward this idea that it was okay at the time. And then as the film unfolds, we see sort of women of Allen's generation being treated with a kind of mockery, whereas Tracy is treated like this sort of innocent goddess. And it was so uncomfortable and painful to watch, both as a former kid, a former girl, but also as a mom, you know, as the mother of a teenage girl. To me, it was almost unwatchable.
Mm-hmm. You explore the question of whether you yourself might be a monster. I was very fascinated by this part of your book. How would you consider yourself possibly being a monster?
I have written two memoirs, and the person I am is a memoirist, and that's all tied up for me in always turning a question back toward myself. As someone who has had the experience as a memoirist and as a critic of looking at things from this intensely subjective lens, I always am asking, well, what about my complicity? How have I participated in this? What have I done wrong in this situation? Because if you are writing memoir and you don't ask those questions, you are writing a bad memoir. You're just standing on a soapbox yelling. You know, you really need to look at your own complicity and sort of behavior with a really critical lens. And so, of course, asking the question, am I a monster, became immediately part of the book, or about even just thinking about the problem. It's like, well, I'm pointing my finger over there, but, you know, it points back at me. What is it that's monstrous about me? And there's several ways that it works. One of the ideas I explore at length in the book is the feeling of being a monster when I turn from my children to do my work. You know, and that's not so much the case anymore because my kids are more grown, but this feeling of guilt about making art when I could be caring for children, obviously that's not monstrous in the sense that the crimes we're talking about are, you know, like sexual assault and racism and saying horrible things. But there's a way in which I felt so guilty about it, and that I was perceived in, you know, that there's a perception that you are less of a mother if you would choose to make art, to walk away and make art. So it's kind of a delicate thing to talk about, right? Because I'm not totalizing those two things. But I wanted to get at this feeling of guilt, of betrayal that came simply from making work.
Yeah. And then it also made me think of the passage where you write about my fellow Canadian, Joni Mitchell. Can you tell us a bit about that, why you included her in the book?
Yeah, I was getting a Canadian feeling from you. There's a chapter where I talk about this notion of abandoning the children and how that's this uniquely female crime. And I look at a couple of people. One is Doris Lessing, who moved from Africa to the UK, leaving behind two children, but taking one child with her, which is so complicated psychically. Mm-hmm. And then the other person I really look at length is Joni Mitchell, who gave her baby up for adoption right around the time that she, as a folk artist, folk singer, was really starting to find literally her voice and be on the cusp of what, of course, is one of the great careers of the 20th century. So she talked about this idea that she had a grandmother who had been an artist and became saddled with children and responsibilities and housekeeping and was so mad about it that she kicked a door down, which is such a fantastically Joni Mitchell image. But mm-hmm. she talks about how this idea that she sort of has to do what she does kind of to rectify that wrong or to do what her grandmother didn't get to do. And so this idea of this tension between, can you be the truly great artist that Joni was with a child? And she made that decision, no. But again, it comes back to this idea of, is that part of what spurred her to greatness? You know, to justify the surrender of the child? Like, we can't know that. These are unanswerable questions. Mm-hmm. But I think she makes a really interesting parable about the tension between care and the quest for greatness in a female artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You say that when we're considering the work of the monster geniuses, we're telling ourselves we're having ethical thoughts, but really what we're having are moral feelings. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think that so much of the project of the book was to kind of almost like scrape away, here's a Wisconsin image, is to, scrape the obscuring frost away so that we can see more clearly what's going on. And in many cases, I feel like this idea of rationality and ethical thought obscures what's really going on. So, you know, we're thinking that we ought to do something, like we ought to respond to the work in a certain way. Either, and that can go either way. It could mean separating the art from the artist, or it could also mean, I hate this word, but canceling the person and sort of getting rid of their work out of this kind of pure ethical decision-making. Mm. And underneath both of those sort of seemingly rational decisions is emotion, right? Like on the one hand, you know, you're thinking you have this ethical problem with, for instance, Woody Allen, but what you're feeling is an emotion. You're feeling hatred or rage or, you know, these are not thoughts, they're feelings. And on the other hand, this idea of separating the art from the artist pretends that we're not having the feelings we're having. So we're creating an ethics in that particular case that ignores feeling altogether, which is utterly impossible. We can't escape biography and we can't escape the feelings that biography makes arise in us. So mm-hmm. what was interesting to me was the way this whole dialogue sort of gets overlaid by people pretending to make a series of decisions, or more importantly, I don't really care what each individual does, telling other people what they ought to think or what decisions they ought to make. And underneath it, I just saw this kind of roiling sea of emotion. And again, as a memoirist, or even just as a very careful writer, immediately I want to get at what's actually happening there. What are these feelings that are actually occurring and how can I best describe them?
Hmm. Do you have any advice for how people who are fans of these artists, how they should deal with this dilemma? Is it okay to love the art but hate the artist?
Well, it's not my job to make it okay. You know, that's obviously the number one kind of onus that's been put on this book is for me to say it's okay. I think that the most important thing is to understand the emotional component of what's occurring. I do actually give an answer toward the end of the book. And what I say is this. I don't think that in the economic system in which we live, like capitalism, I don't think making a choice about ethical consumption is ultimately meaningful. I think that, you know, capitalism wants to hold us in a role as consumers. And if we decide if we're going to be a good or bad consumer, all we're doing is continuing to fulfill this limited role that we have within the sort of larger picture of capital. And I think that that's a false decision. I think that ultimately, you know, whether or not you consume a piece of art doesn't make you a good or bad person. As I say in the book, you're going to have to find some other way to accomplish that. So, yeah, you could look at that as me saying, it's okay to consume the art. It's okay to love what you love.
Mm. Claire Dieterer, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. It's a very thought-provoking and beautifully written book.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Claire Dieterer is the author of Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. You can find out more about Claire at wpr.org/beta.
I view it more like mechanical choreography than like mega, mega bloody violence because I'm just trying to render it as clearly as possible.
Coming up, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya talks about his debut novel, Chain Gang All-Stars. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.